The Cognitive Behavioral Therapy Center of Western North Carolina would like to welcome you to this episode of our podcast, brought to you by BehaviorTherapist.com. Each episode presents news and interviews pertaining to the cognitive behavioral therapies and evidence-based psychotherapy, containing content for consumers and professionals alike. In this episode, Maya Salovitz on the troubled teen industry. Before introducing you to Ms. Salovitz, I'd like to request that you visit http://behaviortherapist.podbean.com. At that location, you can post comments or questions, and you can also enjoy the resources that are associated with each podcast episode. Please also consider making a donation at that same location to help defray costs that are associated with the podcast. No donation is too small, even a dollar would be helpful. Please also visit our e-store at that same location. All the proceeds go, again, to help support the podcast. Now on to Ms. Salovitz. Maya Salovitz is a journalist who covers health, science, and public policy. She is co-author with leading child trauma expert Bruce Perry of Born for Love, Why Empathy is Essential and Endangered, and The Boy Who Was Raised as a Dog and Other Stories from a Child Psychiatrist Notebook, What Traumatized Children Can Teach Us About Loss, Love, and Healing. She's also the author of Help at Any Cost, How the Troubled Teen Industry Cons Parents and Hurts Kids. Much of what we'll be speaking with her today will be coming or reported in that book. And she's also the co-author with Dr. Joseph Volpicelli of the University of Pennsylvania of Recovery Options, The Complete Guide, How You and Your Loved Ones Can Understand and Treat Alcohol and Other Drug Problems. Finally, she has written for numerous major publications, including the New York Times, Time Magazine Online, Elle, The Washington Post, O, The Oprah Magazine, New York Magazine, and The New Scientist. Ms. Salovitz, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Well, why don't we start out with maybe you're telling us what the troubled teen industry is and what got you interested in this area.
Sure. Well, the troubled teen industry is what I call a collection of organizations that provide residential programs for teenagers that take a tough love approach. And these programs are characterized by unskilled staff, very little regulation, and lots of internet advertising. So they may be called wilderness programs, they might be called boot camps, they might be called emotional growth boarding schools, they might be called academies. They're basically called whatever they can name them that will exempt them from regulation. And in terms of how I got interested, I basically was a drug addict in my late teens and early 20s, and I remember reading about these tough love programs as they apply to drug addiction, and I was like, wow, like my fears about people and socializing and being okay were what drove my addiction. So I was kind of like, if people are going to scream at me and humiliate me and attack me, that's going to make me want to get high, not want to get clean. So what on earth is this? And I better avoid treatment. So I'm sure I'm not alone in having had those thoughts. And when I got clean, I just thought, oh my God, I've got to figure out, like, what is it that leads people to have this misguided idea of what would help, and why is this still so popular?
And you mentioned that they were characterized by a tough love approach, and to some degree, I guess that's intuitive, but can you say a little more about what that looks like in practice?
Sure. I mean, the basic idea is that we need to break people in order to fix them. And so the programs will completely isolate the person from the outside world. No letters, no phone calls, no internet, no contact with anybody, even the parents. And they will completely control the environment such that the person gets very little sleep, doesn't get very much food, either gets no exercise or gets way too much. And then the sort of primary characteristic is the emotional atmosphere, which is all about fear and humiliation and emotional attacks. So it's basically designed to break you down using whatever techniques they can.
And how prevalent are these programs at this point in time? Do you have any sense of that?
Well, this is kind of interesting. It's impossible to know because there's no regulation, but there's, at any given time, it's a pretty good guess that there's several hundred of these operating. I mean, if you just sort of count them online, that's about what you come up with. And each of them can hold anywhere from 3 to several hundred kids. So basically, you're talking 10 to 20,000 kids in these particular programs at any given time. There are also legitimately licensed addiction treatment programs that use these same tactics, despite regulation. You know, those account for some other cases as well.
In your list of the different types of titles that these programs might use, one was wilderness programs. My first question is, are they really the same kind of program, just with different titles, or do they have slightly different bents?
They really are quite the same. There are certainly some wilderness programs that do use credentialed therapists and that attempt not to have this kind of oppressive atmosphere. But the problem is that staff turnover tends to be very high, and the industry is pervaded with this philosophy. So even the so-called good programs will ignore kids' complaints and say, oh, that child is just manipulating, you know, she really doesn't have a health problem. And kids have died as a result of that. So, you know, it's possible that there are one or two that are genuinely good and that don't have any of this stuff in them, but good luck finding them because they all claim that and there's no regulation.
And you mentioned that they all claim to be effective. In your research, were you able to come across any good empirical or peer-reviewed literature on the outcomes of these programs?
No, there is none whatsoever. And to me, given that there have been deaths and there's no proof of efficacy, this is why I can't recommend them to anybody.
Any ideas what these programs cost?
A lot of money. They can range from a couple thousand a month. One of them that I investigated recently was charging $7,000 a month. They are very, very expensive. And what's amazing is that this allows enormous profits because if you think about it, if you're running a wilderness program, you don't even need to have a facility. If you're paying your staff minimum wage, that's not a big expense either. And yet you're charging several hundred dollars a day for this service.
Does insurance cover any of these programs?
Occasionally, it will cover some of them. I haven't looked at that very closely, but I do know that some people have gotten reimbursed for insurance in some of these ones that are licensed by some state. You know, some states have attempted to regulate them following deaths, Utah most notoriously, but Utah continued to have deaths after they regulated them, and they basically have one regulator for several hundred programs. And the other problem with regulating wilderness programs is that the best way to regulate something is to be able to do surprise inspection. It's very hard to do a surprise inspection if they have to tell you where they are before you can inspect them.
Do you have any ideas on how these might be better regulated, or would you like to see them close
up? I don't think there's any justification for these programs until you can prove that they work. So as far as I'm concerned, they should be considered experimental, and the only programs that should be done should be in the context of a randomized trial. I also think that the wilderness itself can probably be tremendously healing for the right kid. And what I do say to parents who have those kinds of kids is that, you know, if your kid is not doing so well and they feel like they want a challenge and, you know, they are interested in the outdoors, send them to Outward Bound. Not the Outward Bound for troubled kids, but the Outward Bound for regular kids. Because that way you aren't isolating them with a group of other kids who are stigmatized as being bad kids, who may well indeed be teaching your kids things that you probably didn't intend to have them be taught. And also then if they complain, if something goes wrong, nobody's going to not believe them because they are ordinary kids who volunteered to go there. The thing that I think people forget when they think about what is therapeutic and what isn't is that it's enormous difference to take on the challenge of, say, something like Mount Everest by, you know, choosing to do that. If I choose to climb Mount Everest, I'm choosing to put myself through all these risks and, you know, set this goal for myself. If I'm forced to climb Mount Everest, that's basically torture. And the physiology of your stress response is completely different when you're in a situation where you feel safe and in control and are choosing to take on a challenge versus having no control and feeling completely unsafe. And these programs create those kinds of conditions, and we know that those are the conditions that are risky for creating post-traumatic stress disorder.
In the lead-up to that, or the beginning of your answer there, you said something I think is pretty important, and I know there's a literature on this. I know you've written about this, and I'm wondering if you can elaborate, and that is sort of that actually one of the worst things you can do is put problem behavior folks together in the same place.
Yeah. Basically, we know from neuroscience and sociology and a lot of other disciplines that people copy each other. We have neurons specially in order to allow us to do that, and these are very good neurons because they allow us to empathize with each other. But they also mean that if you put your kid in a deviant peer group, they're likely to copy stuff that we probably wouldn't want them to copy. And if they are in a peer group that's norms are more ordinary, their behavior will tend to be less extreme. So concentrating troubled kids together in itself has been shown to make them worse. And this is something that I try to tell parents, particularly who are worried about, oh, my kid is like smoking pot and drinking on the weekends. Well, 70 to 80% of kids are going to be doing that. And if you take that child and put them in with a bunch of heroin injectors and cocaine smokers, that's not what you want to be teaching them, especially since most of these programs and most of the, unfortunately, legitimate addiction programs will tell all the kids who are in there that they are addicts and they have to go to 12-step meetings for the rest of their lives because they have a chronic relapsing disease. And since most of those kids, we actually don't know whether or not they're addicts, that can become a self-fulfilling prophecy. So you have sort of two different things going on. You have the pure contagion stuff going on, and you have labeling going on. So the best treatment for somebody who has, you know, a mild problem, let's say somebody is, you know, smoking pot and their grades are going down and they are not very happy and things are not going well and they're not getting along with their parents. Counseling on an outpatient basis does not put them in touch with more deviant peers. And if you get somebody who knows how to work with teenagers well, they can help them figure out their own reasons why this might not be such a good idea. And people do way better when they're motivated by their own reasons for doing things rather than, oh, I have to do this to please my parents.
And what would you say to parents who maybe have a child that's doing more than just smoking a little bit of pot? Let's say the behavior's pretty extreme, or at least their perception is that it's very extreme, and they feel that they've been to individual therapy, they've tried family therapy, and are looking at this as the last option.
Right. I actually think family therapy should be given another try in that circumstance, unless the person is immediately a danger to themselves or others. I think residential treatment, we have no evidence that it helps anything. And, you know, we certainly have evidence that it can do harm. So the only reason to lock someone away from people is if they are an immediate danger to themselves and others and they need medication stabilization. So if you're going to put your kid in something residential, it should be a psychiatric hospital. It should be a licensed facility. It should be a facility that allows you to visit whenever you want, that encourages contact between you and the child, that does everything to welcome you, and that does everything to empower the child and get them out of there as quickly as possible. There are certainly circumstances where people who have very severe disabilities or children who have been in multiple foster homes and nobody will take them will have to be in some kind of residential setting for a while. But those are the rare cases. And so you may need respite, but that's a different circumstance than treating the kid to help the kid. And a very sad thing about our system is that we really don't have the kinds of resources that we should have in order to help the children who do have really severe problems. But we know that this stuff isn't especially helpful, basically, and that in these facilities, there's, you know, as much risk as there is outside them. You know, and people just think, well, oh, if we just lock them up, at least they'll be safe. The problem is if you lock them up with unqualified staff and they can't talk to the outside world, they're not going to be safe because they can't complain if they're being abused. And who's going to work in these places for minimum wage?
Would I be correct in assuming that much of the marketing that these places do is in the form of anecdotes and testimonials rather than, well, I guess there is an absence of peer-reviewed literature. They can't be relying on that.
That's right. I mean, Aspen Education happily promotes a non-controlled study that they did, of their facilities that, had some kind of insanely high dropout rate in terms of following up people. So, it's got pretty much every methodological flaw you would not want to see in a study. So they will make that claim, but, ask them if it's been peer-reviewed, ask them if it's been published in the literature, no. So, yes, they have these very moving testimonials from both kids and parents who've been through this, and, if you watch them, you would think, oh, my God, this is great. The problem is that you can find those same exact testimonials for completely quackish cancer cures that have killed people. And it's, human beings are susceptible to stories. I'm a writer, I know this, and I think stories have a very good power that should be used, but you should use the stories to illustrate, what we know works, not just to make claims about something you're trying to sell.
And I think that's a real hang-up for a lot of parents, is they are very moved by these testimonials and don't often understand why controlled studies are so important. And I know you've just been commenting on the importance of that. I wonder if you could, what would you say, anything else to parents about that, about why that is so important?
Sure. The reason that medicine has advanced the way it did in the last, 100 years or so is really down to the controlled clinical trial. And we do these studies, and they're done in this way because that's the only way to get rid of extraneous variables that can make things look like they work. One of the things that classically is done to inflate success rates for addiction treatment has been to say, we have a 90% success rate with graduates. They don't mention that 80% drop out in the first 2 weeks. So that's one thing that there's all kinds of things that can make something look successful that, aren't real factors and that don't prove that it actually works. The only way you can really tell if something works is to compare it to someone who did not get that treatment. And the thing that people also really forget about teenagers and about treatment for teenagers is that simply naturally over time, teenagers grow up. And so an enormous amount of the success attributed to the treatment is actually simple maturity. So again, that's another reason you really need a controlled trial to see if these kids are getting better because they're growing up or they're getting better because of what's going on in the treatment. So it's really important to, look for data and to realize what can be hidden if there is not research.
You've done a really good job, discussing some of the ways that these programs might be harmful. In particular, you talked at length about the peer deviancy training. I'm imagining that a lot of parents and concerned others may think to themselves, well, even if it doesn't work, it certainly can't hurt. Or we're willing to take the risk of them being around these deviant peers. Are there other ways that these treatments might hurt?
Well, yes. And one of the biggest risks, well, there's several risks. The first one is that one of the few things we know successfully helps counter addiction in the long term is education. People who have been through college, if they become addicted, they're much more likely to recover. So if you spend the college fund on one of these programs, which often is what happens, your child is going to, A, get a much worse education within the program, and B, not be able to afford as good a college as they can get. So right there, you've got a harm that a lot of people don't think about. The other harm that is quite significant is if they get abused in treatment. Now, all of this treatment involves emotional abuse because it's all about confrontation, humiliation, and, making kids feel horrible about themselves. The idea is afterwards that they're going to build them up again, but that is often just not done. And we know very well how to break people, but we don't really know very well how to fix them. So all that stuff where you are attacking and humiliating and basically lowering their self-esteem is, obviously not good for you. And what's also bad about it is that it can produce this kind of extreme uncontrollable stress is a trigger for all kinds of genetic predisposition. So if your kid has any kind of predisposition to depression or anxiety or really anything, even psychotic disorders, they can be worsened by extreme stress. And of course, these things can create post-traumatic stress disorder in themselves, and that doubles your risk of addiction. So there is a real danger of not only doing harm, but of actually increasing the risk of the thing you're actually trying to prevent. I mean, it's really sad, because most of the parents that I have spoken with, an overwhelming majority of them, they really want to do the right thing. They were really concerned about their kids. They checked things out. They thought they were doing the right thing, and they were taken in by these guys. And the fact is that the government does not protect you from this stuff. We don't have an FDA for behavioral health, and we don't have very good enforcement on advertising. One of the things that has astonished me for a long time is that psychologists and psychiatrists have just acquiesced and let these amateurs take over the language of therapy and advertise as being able to treat conditions like addictions and bipolar and all kinds of other things that they have no, you know, qualifications to be able to treat. Like, if I go out and claim that I can cure cancer, I'm not allowed to do that. But I can go out and claim that I can cure depression and ADD and all kinds of other things in my wilderness program, and psychologists and psychiatrists will go ahead and refer people to it.
Do they ever make the argument, and I don't know, I'm just speculating, that, well, maybe they have one licensed person on staff, or they had some licensed person design some aspect of the program or anything like that, and then a bunch of paraprofessionals, or?
Oh, sure. I mean, it was very interesting, because this place called Mount Bachelor Academy that was actually making kids do lap dances as part of their treatment, which recently got shut down by the state of Oregon, they had claimed, that everything was professionally designed and it was all therapeutic and et cetera, et cetera. Turned out there was one licensed person on staff who didn't even see all the kids. And that place was charging $7,000 or, $6,500, something like that, a month. And it was actually getting funded from schools would send their kids there to treat ADHD. So they were getting federal education money spent on this complete nonsense.
Tell us about who these educational consultants are and what you've learned about them with your research.
Basically, they are people who will tell the parents, yes, we know that there's bad ones out there, but we can find you a good one. They are supposed to be experts at, finding the right placement for your particular troubled child. The problem here is that there's no research that shows that anything of these work, so you can't even match anything by any kind of standard anyway. And they are not licensed. They don't have to have any kind of particular qualifications. And many of them have been found to take kickbacks. So basically, you call up the educational consultant and they say, oh, I've got the perfect place for your kid. And in this instance that was reported in congressional testimony, it was the husband referring to his wife's program. And of course, he did not disclose that he was married to this person. There's all kinds of issues with these consultants, and they get paid an enormous amount of money to do all kinds of tests, and, they appear to be professional. And, some of them have qualifications, and some of them do quite good work in terms of helping kids find colleges and stuff like this. But their connection with the, therapeutic school has really been deeply problematic, and a lot of them are former employees of some of these places, so they just believe in the ideas that support them.
Going back to some of the stuff that goes on in some of these places, apparently, there have been a number of, and you've written about quite a few legal proceedings, and you've told us about a few of them. Is there any major one that might be pretty representative of the kinds of things parents should worry about that you'd want to tell us about?
Well, I mean, you can tell all the particular horror stories. For example, the story of Aaron Bacon, who slowly died over several weeks from a ulcer that could have been treated with an over-the-counter medication. He was in a wilderness program, and they, even as he lost control over his bodily functions and lost something like 30 pounds over a couple of weeks, they continued to claim that he was faking and continued to do things like take away his blanket so he had to sleep outside in, you know, sub-zero temperatures with a condition that ultimately killed him. And as he lay dying, they were making fun of him. So, you know, I mean, that's about as bad as it can get. You know, there's other cases where the lap dance place that I was just mentioning, they actually had girls who had been sexually abused, and they made them do lap dances for boys, and supposedly as a way to show them what their future was going to be like if they continued to be sexually promiscuous. And they, you know, even if these girls may not have even actually been sexually promiscuous, but the idea was that, you know, they should be shamed for their role in choosing to have been abused. Because the bizarre thing about the philosophy of these places is that you are totally responsible for everything that happens to you. So, yes, if you got raped, you asked for it. And that is just so sick that people have a very hard time believing that that's indeed what is being conveyed, but it is.
My jaw is hitting the ground. It's just incredible. What sort of tips, you're obviously very knowledgeable about this, or suggestions, more specific suggestions, I guess, you've given us some general ones for parents who have teens, and let's again assume that we're maybe at the extreme of the continuum, that we're, I think it's pretty clear that if we're not at the extreme, that maybe just some individual therapy, perhaps family therapy would be indicated, but you know, you've got really out of control behavior, perhaps even being abusive towards the parents and so forth. What, what would you recommend?
Well, the research on this is that there's a type of treatment called multisystemic family therapy. Unfortunately, it's primarily available in the juvenile justice system, but they've studied that with families, and what happens there is the therapist actually comes into the home and helps the parent take control and helps the child find pleasurable activities that are not destructive. And, you know, this has been used with kids who are violent. And it has reduced, you know, recidivism and use of institutional settings and, you know, overall friction. So although it just sounds like, oh, it's too mild, you know, family therapy, that couldn't really work. The thing is that, like, you know, you can say, well, we tried this and it didn't work. You have to keep trying. There is no quick fix. And that's the problem here, because people are desperate for, you know, they want to go sort of up the ladder and find some intense solution for this really intense and difficult problem. And they want it, you know, to just be solved. And the problem is, for these extreme situations, this is something that has usually not just appeared in adolescence. Sort of severe behavior problems that appear in adolescence tend to resolve, you know, with time. But severe behavior problems that have started, you know, in infancy or toddlerhood, those are probably going to be lifelong mental illnesses. And that is something that nobody has an answer for. You know, this stuff can help, but, you know, it's a long, you know, and I wish I could say something, you know, oh, just do this or that. But, it, you know, we really need a much better mental health system in this country, and we just don't have it.
And as I mentioned before, I highly recommend your book to folks. I'm going to put that on our blog so everybody can access that information. Can you recommend any other resources?
I'm just trying to think in terms of for parents.
Yeah, or even...
I mean, you know, for parents with, you know, genuinely mentally ill kids, the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill can be really helpful. For kids who have been through these places and are struggling and want to do something to help other kids, there's an organization called the Coalition for the Ethical Treatment of Youth, and they are great and, you know, help kids, you know, sort of find each other and, you know, get over this experience and, you know, organize to help other people. There's also an organization that is called ASTAR, which is... It includes professionals and parents who have lost kids to these places, and they, you know, offer support. Both of these organizations are new and small and could really use more support, so I definitely recommend, you know, getting in touch with them. In terms of, you know, the The good news is that most teenage problems are not on the severe end of the spectrum. You know, and even, you know, we all know kids who smoked pot every day through high school, went on to college, did fine. And then we all know a couple of them that did. And so it's one of those things where there really aren't easy answers. But the most important thing for almost all of this and for recovery in the long term for any kind of mental illness is family support and friend support, just social support in general. Because, drugs, medications, therapy, all of that is great and probably essential in a lot of places and very helpful. But if people are going to have long-term recovery from anything, they need social support. So one of the best things you can do is just the most obvious, which is love your kids.
Ms. Salovitz, I want to not only thank you for your time today, but I want to thank you for doing all this research and bringing this to the public's awareness.
Thank you.
Tune in next time when we speak with Dr. Leslie Sokol about the new book, Think Confident, Be Confident, a 4-step program to eliminate doubt and achieve lifelong self-esteem. Also still to come, we'll be speaking with Drs. Abigail Kalkin and Anne-Marie Albano. Again, please visit http://behaviortherapist.podbean.com and enjoy the resources that support the podcast at that location. Thank you, and we look forward to next time.